Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to FedSoc Forums. My name is Elias Wright. I'm a third-year law student. I also serve as student liaison for the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group. As a reminder, all opinions expressed by those of our speakers, not of the Federalist Society, as the Federalist Society takes no positions. Today's program is titled USPTO Examination Updates and Evolving Patent Eligibility Standards. We're very pleased to welcome the excellent group of panelists. Dr. Julie Burke, the former TC1600 Quality Assurance Specialist, is founder of IP Quality Pro LLC, where she acts as an expert witness on patent office procedures and practices. She helps practitioners resolve complicated procedural situations with U.S. patent practice. She's also an advisor for Petition.ai. From 2006 to 2015, in her role as QAS, Dr. Burke drafted over 800 petition submissions for review and signature by a variety of TC1600 practitioners. Noelle Ignatios is DivX's Chief Executive Officer and Chief Legal Officer, as well as a member of its management committee. She leads a global team that builds industry solutions ranging from SDKs with an installed base of 2 billion products to digital media software and over a billion downloads. Before joining DivX, Noelle advised companies on intellectual property portfolio management, enforcement, and licensing matters. Noelle began her career working in private practice at Camellia LLP, where she oversaw the intellectual property portfolios of major Silicon Valley technology and social media companies, and represented wireless technology companies in global patent litigation and arbitration. Eli Mazur is of counsel at Foley & Lardner, for the most patent-savvy in-house counsel of business executives, turn to him for strategic guidance and solutions to their most complex and high-stakes patent challenges. Previously served as a patent attorney and partner at Harity & Harity for 13 years. Eli's passion for connecting with people led him to create Clause 8, a widely followed IP Problem podcast featuring the most significant voices in the IP. Clint Mahal is a partner at Davidson LLC. Clint has prosecuted hundreds of U.S. patent applications from filing to issuance, and he has filed over 100 appeals for USPTO patent trials, where he has an exceptional rate. He also has experience collaborating with foreign attorneys on patent applications in Europe, Japan, and China, litigating patents, post-grant proceedings, and applying elsewhere. Currently, he serves as the co-chair of NYIP LA's Patent Law and Practice Committee. Our moderator is John Williams, who is a second-generation patent attorney that handles patent preparation and prosecution in the AI and robotics space. He's also an adjunct professor at Trinity Law School and member of the IP Watchdog Advisory. John also served as a member of the Executive Committee for the Federalist Society's IP Practice Group. One note for our audience before we begin. If you have any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them to Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen, not the chat, so that we'll be able to access them later. That note, I'll turn the things over to our speakers to start the conversation. John, thank you so much for joining us for moderating today's discussion.
All right, thank you very much. And yes, once again, thanks to everyone for joining us. I'd like to set the stage a little bit, and then I will open the panel up with some opening thoughts. So in the past year, the USPTO has undergone some significant changes, and probably more so than we've seen in recent memory. Director Squires arrived with a clear agenda, a pro-patent, pro-innovation posture for the office, a determination to reduce a massive examination backlog, a willingness to restructure how examiners are supervised and evaluated, and a new posture towards the post-grant challenge mechanisms that have shaped patent litigation for over a decade. The effects have rippled across prosecution and litigation. The ex-parte Desjardins decision and the director-level memos on subject matter eligibility have reset how practitioners are thinking about Section 101, particularly in the AI and software invention space. New performance metrics and supervisory requirements for patent examiners are changing what applicants can expect during prosecution. And the sharp decline in IPR institution rates has sent challengers scrambling toward ex-party re-exam in numbers we have not seen in years, raising real questions about whether that mechanism is being pushed beyond its proper role. To walk us through all this, we've got an all-star panel here with deep practical insight and knowledge on these sorts of things. Our panelists bring frontline experience and sophisticated strategic perspective on what these changes mean for patent applicants and patentees alike. So with that, let's begin with some opening remarks. And Julie, I'd like to start with you. What is the first thing that's top of mind that our viewers should keep in mind today?
Well, thank you, John. Thank the Federalist Society for hosting this important topic right now. Just yesterday, President Trump issued an executive order, which is across the government, but it'll definitely affect the Patent Office, perhaps predominantly more than some other agencies. It's to increase accountability in the federal workforce. And to restore this accountability, they're reclassifying 8,000 senior level policy influencing positions in the schedule policy career section. And these are your top level civil service positions, GS-15 and SES, senior executive series employees, of which the Patent Office has rafts of them. And they are all like a layer cake, supervising each other all the way down. The commissioner supervises a deputy commissioner who supervises assistant deputy commissioners. And then we have the supervisory patent examiners. They're GS-15. And a handful of patent examiners are also in the GS-15 senior level category. I understand this is equivalent to a 3-star general in the military. So we've got 3-star general level positions with 6 more layers of upper management above that. And to be able to make these employees be more accountable and to be able to work with the administration changing directions it wants to go, this is a very interesting time right now.
All right, thank you. Eli, what's top of mind for you?
Hey, thanks, everyone. Well, I agree, John, that it's been one of the most eventful times at the USPTO, and I think it actually started before John Squires was even there. They have the acting director, Coke Morgan Stewart, and now Solicitor Nick Matich, who are alums of the USPTO, and I think they came in knowing what they were going to do and what they thought things need to be fixed. And I think the big two things were on the post-grant side, too many patents were being invalidated, and I think they started to rein that in. On top of mind is whether the USPTO is going to manage to do anything that's going to outlast this administration, and that will probably have to happen with legislative changes, and I haven't really seen a push from the administration to do that on the legislative side. The other issue, I think, is the is a backlog issue that they inherited from the previous administration. So a lot of the USPTO has too many patent applications, not enough examiners. And I think they've tried to kind of figure out a way to kind of squeeze as much as they could out of the examiners that they have. You mentioned the one-on-one thing. It hasn't kind of, they've been trying a lot, but it doesn't seem to have made kind of an impact. So that's something I'm watching. I think, I've written about how I think David Kaplos, he inherited a similar issue and he empowered examiners. So it's going to be interesting to see if the USPTO eventually comes around to that model. So that's what I'm kind of watching.
Okay, great. Thanks. Noelle, let's go to you. What comes up for you?
Thanks, John, and thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me. As mentioned in my introduction, I'm the CEO and Chief Legal Officer at DivX, and DivX is a streaming video technology company that's been around since the year 2000, based in San Diego. So I think what's been very interesting to watch over the past year and a half is the real change in tide from Director Vidal and, frankly, her lack of action and sort of sideshow focus, as opposed to really trying to help America create good patents and be able to enforce those good patents in the United States and their counterparts abroad. One of the things that our company has really faced is licensing holdouts in big tech, as well as theft and unlicensed use by Chinese companies. And we had thought that the purpose of the USPTO was to strengthen US patent rights. But under the Vidal administration, that did not happen. Under Director Squires, Coke Morgan Stewart, and Mr. Maddock, we've certainly seen a change in tide. And if anything, just an appreciation for patent rights are something that our government should care about and should enforce and should help patent owners. I think that's why the USPTO is created. This is the first time since I've been a practitioner that I feel as though that they're really standing behind the purpose of the institution. So we've seen a lot of independent changes. I think what we're dealing with now is just a change in tactic by licensing holdouts, and how PTAB and the USPTO responds to that will be really interesting to watch. But it certainly is a time of change, as others have said.
Okay, great. Thank you. Clint, let's go to you, last but not least.
Yeah, kind of honestly reiterate a lot of what everybody else talked about. Like, there's three, you know, main issues that are kind of ongoing at the patent office that are interesting to me. You know, first, post-grant challenges, you know, they're trying to rein them in, which I think is a very, you know, noble purpose, because I think the system has been gamed by defendants for years, and, you know, it limits the amount of, you know, licenses and things along those lines. And number two, patent eligibility. Like, it's, you know, just a mess right now. You deal with, you know, different examiners at the patent office, you get a different solution. You know, call up the examiner and try to figure out, you know, how narrow your invention has to be to get a patent on it. And it's super subjective. I think both of those two things, like the post-grant stuff and the patent eligibility, you know, really should be addressed by Congress. Third is just running the office, which is, you know, honestly, a very, very difficult job. You know, there's 10,000 patent examiners. You're trying to churn out patents that are of quality, but you also, you know, can't have a monster backlog. We have a monster backlog, and, you know, they're trying to pull levers at the patent office to increase examination time. You know, I think it's something that, you know, you mess with one thing, you screw up another. You mess with examination time too much, you get rid of, you know, you drop examiner morale, and then that screws up examination. So, you know, it's a very tricky process. I think Squires is kind of, you know, figuring that out and trying to get more hands on to, you know, figure out the best way to do it, because it's not easy.
All right, thanks. So those are our three big topics for the day. So that's a good segue. We're going to be doing eligibility, what's going on within the patent office with the examining core, and post-grant challenges. But let's start with eligibility. And we're going to talk about some of the specific policies in a moment. But Clint, I'll go right back to you. Have you seen anything overall move the needle? Is it easier to get past eligibility rejections now? Are you seeing less of them? What are you seeing?
So on the examiner side, I haven't seen a real difference. You know, I think that, you know, as we all commonly discuss, like, the best way to get around a patent eligibility rejection is to call the examiner up and try to talk the examiner through it. Like, you can argue case law all you want. You know, you can argue that the latest, you know, USPTO policy, which, you know, can be helpful to a degree, but there's, you know, like 50 examples that you can argue. Like, you know, it's just a mess trying to sort it out with directly contacting the examiners. But the biggest change has been at the PTAB. When you appeal rejections, the reversal rate for 101 rejections has always been insanely low. I think it's like been around 10%, you know, for the last number of years. It's jumped up quite a bit. I think it's like getting close to 30 to 40%, which is, you know, a direct result of Director Squires issuing that ex parte appeal decision to Sargins, and then not just issuing it, you know, popping out a memo sent out to all the, you know, all the examining corps and the PTAB on it, and then putting it in the MPEP, which, you know, I haven't really seen a huge change because of it. But I think any of changes with an examiner core kind of take a little while to get used to, and they still haven't done training on it. So there has been, you know, big time changes at the PTAB, which I think are positive. I think, you know, they're trying to do a better job of, you know, evaluating the claim as a whole and not picking apart each individual element and saying, oh, that's abstract, that's, you know, well known, which, you know, just, you can do that with any invention and essentially turn it into ineligible patent subject matter. So
Okay, thanks. Eli, prosecution is right in your wheelhouse too. So what do you think? Has there been a meaningful change?
Yeah, I haven't, like I said, I have a similar experience to Clint. I haven't seen a change. I know that the USPTO, starting in August of 2025, they've issued a series of memos to the examiners saying, things should be different now, reminding them of particular things. For example, the USPTO has a series of examples. The most favorable one for panel eligibility of artificial intelligence was example 39. And during the last administration, you started hearing that example 39 is no longer in force. And then in August, the USPTO put out a memo saying, no, that's not the case. Example 39 is good. An examiner should follow it. But I had an interview actually yesterday, which was it was outside actually of the business method arguments and the AI arguments, but the supervisor, he was an examiner in the AI art units. And he started saying, well, example 39 is no longer, it doesn't apply anymore. So it goes to show you that all the other stuff that we mentioned, even a supervisor is not aware of the changes. And I know the USPTO has a plan to train examiners. But I know it's a huge priority for John Squires. He talked about it on day one. He put a lot of effort to it. Now it's time for the examiners to apply what he wants them to do. And I know he's talked to examiners directly. So I think it's a good subject for him to address the examiners directly on. About actually doing what they're supposed to on 101 based on the latest guidance.
All right, thanks. Noel, what about you? I imagine your company has faced some 101 rejections before. Are you seeing any difference?
I wouldn't say we're seeing a huge difference. And frankly, a lot of our IP is further along in the process, John. We have a robust portfolio of over 600 assets that have priority dates back to the early 2000s. But in the instances we have run into, I would say that, there's huge variation between the examiners. And so I do think that the quality control measures that the USPTO is engaged in now, and I believe Dr. Burke wants to speak about or has spoken about, is really fundamental there, because it's important that there's some sort of uniformity in how the employees are making their decisions, and that it seems like sometimes you just end up with someone who doesn't like you. And then unfortunately you're going to have to go through a much longer process, when particularly if your subject matter and your IP families have been around for a while, one would expect that it shouldn't necessarily get extremely harder and more hostile over time.
Okay, thanks. I think we should go down that path now then. We talked about it during our pre-call, but Julie, what do you think? How do we get more uniform examinations out of the patent office? What can we do?
Oh, that is such a great question. And the Department of Commerce Office of Inspector General has delved into that. The GAO has looked at that. There's been hardcore series of report after report. Most of the reports are titled, "The USPTO Has an Opportunity to Improve, Fill in the Blank, Compliance with Ethics, Quality, Consistency Among the Examiners." And those reports come out under Republican and Democratic administrations and fall on deaf ears. It's a very hard position Director Squires is in right now to do something with this agency. The agency is impervious to oversight. Don't believe me? I'd like to read you a very short quote from an OMB economist who put this in the public records in 2011. I think it applies just as much now. He was trying to get the patent office to follow the rules, government rules, right? Let alone trying to follow changes in policy when a new administration takes in. He wrote, "My general message is unambiguous and uncomplicated." This is Richard Beltzer, economist at the office of OMB back in the day, 2011. "The USPTO is a longstanding serial violator of established regulatory principles. This is a product of a bureaucratic culture that treats presidential direction as interference, is adamantly opposed to basing regulatory decision-making on informed analysis, and has serious difficulty adhering to the rule of law. Each of these deficiencies is by itself a likely reason for bureaucratic failure, but in combination, they make success virtually impossible. Correcting them requires a radical change in the organization's culture. This is what Director Squires is facing.
Yeah, it's a tough task.
Big lift.
Yep.
Yeah, can't have supervisors following the memo, right? You know, Clint just had that, or Eli just, they don't even follow the memos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
another point I wanted to just make on that really briefly, which is I think the Director Squires may have touched on this, but I've certainly heard it spoken about recently about examiners, is for a long time, there's just been this unspoken understanding that a lot of examiners spend their time at the USPTO, whether it's 2 years, 5 years, and they go in a straight hiring pipeline to big tech as in-house patent attorneys. And I think that that is questionable at best. It certainly could form the basis for prejudice when you consider the salary differential between working for the government and being a big tech in-house employee. And I think something should be done about that.
Okay, thanks. So keeping with the theme of eligibility for right now, let's talk about the Desjardins decision a little bit. So for those who don't know, that was a PTAB decision that basically said that methods of training an ML model can be patent eligible. That is in stark contrast to a Federal Circuit decision that came out around the same time and basically held the opposite. But I'm curious to hear, you know, maybe from Clint or Eli, have you been arguing the PTAB case and how much success have you had with it? And maybe this time, let's start with Eli.
Yeah, I think actually the Desjardins decisions has gotten more notice than some of the other memos, which I think is a positive. And I think it's because it was such a unique circumstance where the USPTO director reversed the panel decision and was one of the panelists. So I think they got some attention. But I think it is, you know, the problem is the mess that is Section 101. But I think if, I mean, on the facts of it, if you can, if you have an invention that involves machine learning and you can point to some technical improvements, I think it's very helpful. As I think multiple panelists have said, there's a lot of variation among examiners, but I think it's been a pretty useful tool, I guess, to get examiners to focus on, you know, because somewhere under the pressure that anything related to AI is not patent eligible. So it's a good way to kind of refocus them on that. That's not the case. But I think your point about the Federal Circuit is decision, you know, coming out differently is continues. And I think it's becoming, it's continuing to be extremely difficult to reconcile some of these patent eligibility decisions in courts at the USPTO and so forth.
Been that way for a long time now, unfortunately. Yeah. Clint, I'll go to you, and maybe if you can speak to how you've addressed it in appeals, the Desjardins decision. Have you used it? Has it been persuasive, or is it still too new to have gotten anything back from the PTAB?
Yeah, I thankfully have not filed a ex parte appeal on a 101 rejection since it was issued. You know, I do think it's one of those things where there's a ton of good language in there, you know, like, because generally in a 101 analysis, examiners in the PTAB will, you know, dismiss certain processing steps as being something that can be performed in the mind or that is a mathematical process, and we'll go through each step and do that. And Desjardins kind of says essentially that, you know, these software steps can be an improvement based on EnFish, and that, you know, they're not necessarily, even if they're math, you know, centric, which they, every single, you know, AI machine learning invention is math centric, that it can still be, you know, looking at the claim as a whole, it can still improve the technology, which I think is super powerful language. And I think it's legally correct. I don't think there's anything, you know, in recentive along those lines that you can distinguish Desjardins over. So I think it is absolutely the correct decision. And, you know, there's good support in the specification for the improvements. But you get on the phone with examiners and they often will say, oh, well, you know, that was pretty fact specific and narrow and was not intended to, you know, cover, you know, your improvement. Like, this is improvement in math, this is improvement in mental processes, you know. So, like, I particularly if you're in the business method art units, even if you add some super technical features, you know, you're in the business method art unit already. So they think it's, you know, just mental processes and math. So it really is sometimes difficult to, you know, convince examiners that something is comparable, and especially when there's, you know, 100 cases already that say something's patent ineligible. So, you know, it's, I would love to say that it's made a difference, but, you know, it's really tricky getting the examiner to actually, you know, think that your case is analogous to Desjardins.
Yeah. It's very selective, isn't it? They just apply it however they want.
Yeah, which is just why we need legislation, because there's just so much crappy language out there in federal circuit cases from over the last decade that can be applied to any computer invention. So essentially, you're stuck narrowing your claims until the examiner's like, yeah, this won't be a problem. No one will ever infringe this and it will never make it to the federal circuit. So I'll grant the patent on it, you know?
Yeah. All right. We could make a whole hour out of just subject matter eligibility, and we won't. But there is one more thing I wanted to touch on, and that is subject matter eligibility declarations. This is a new thing that's being pushed by Director Squires, or just suggested, not necessarily pushed. He issued a couple of memos in December about it, and then a follow-up one at the end of April, encouraging the patent bar to file them in certain instances. Now, I tend to, you know, fall on the side of don't file them if you don't have to, because it just creates additional witnesses for potential litigation down the line. But Clint, you and I just talked about this last week, and you brought up a good point, which is if you don't have a patent, you don't have anything to argue about anyway. So if we could get into that a little bit, you know, when do you file one? Do you do it preemptively, or I guess, you know, freely, or do you do it only as a last resort? And have you been doing it at all?
So I've done it once, and it was for a particularly tough case that the SPI was on an interview and encouraged it. You know, I always think, you know, examiner interviews always the best way to resolve a 101 rejection. But if you get on the phone with the examiner and they want you to get too specific and too narrow, you know, then you're better off trying to go broader in filing, you know, a subject matter eligibility declaration, because if you can get broad coverage, but maybe make some admissions on the record that you won't, I think that's better than getting more narrow coverage, you know, and not having anything on the record. And there was an event a few months ago, and there was some district court judges speaking, and I asked them about subject matter eligibility declarations and whether they think it would be helpful to, you know, getting around a summary judgment motion. And they all very, very definitively said yes, because we can't always tell, you know, why this is inventive, you know, if you can get something that's straight from the inventor or one of skill in the art on record, it's way better than just having attorney argument. You can at least point to that, as opposed to, you know, something that's like possibly being manufactured after the patent is granted, that's, you know, not necessarily that clear from the history. So they want to be able to, you know, get it past summary judgment, but they also, you know, are, I think, very skeptical of, you know, just what an attorney says without, know, someone that is actually, you know, skilled in the art.
Okay. Eli, is the other prosecutor on the panel, what do you think?
I mean, I agree with everything Clint says, but I think the program itself, I don't think was worthwhile. They found a clever solution, but they never properly identified the problem. Because the problem is sometimes the specification itself has the same exact thing that you would want to have in the declaration describing the technical improvements in the way you want a declaration. The examiners don't buy it for whatever reason, because they're trained or because they're afraid of getting errors or whatever it is. That's really the problem. That's why they're making the 101 rejection. So putting all that same information then in the declaration, like Clint said, maybe it makes sense in those cases where the supervisor and the examiner say that's a good idea, and you don't have that in the specification. But it doesn't solve the problem of all these, very deficient one-on-one rejections floating around and the examiners refusing to withdraw them for other reasons that have nothing to do with, the technical improvements not being cleared from the record.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
If I could chime in again on this, I would say that the biggest defect in the guidance that is given on the SMEDs is there is, reasonably, obviously it was a reasonable way to do it, but, there's language in there talking about, have a declaration and like further evidence that your, claim is patent eligible. Well, like, how often is there evidence of a technical improvement in something? This is usually something to back on. There's not like press releases like, technical improvement, made. This is why we're so successful. It's not our marketing department, So I would like to, that's because the SMED that I submitted was a very technical distinction of why this is better, than the closest prior art. And I would like to see some emphasis on that. If you can technically explain, I think it should be, almost like supporting an inherency rejection as an examiner, like evidence and or technical reasoning. Like I would think that would be a much better next step and something that would be, more helpful for applicants.
If I could chime in real quickly, the examiners work towards their performance plan. The PTAB was set up in theory because we had these bad quality patents. That was 2010. Ever since then, the patent office has watered down the quality element to the patent examiner's performance plan. It's really nice to think about submitting these declarations and evidence. Right now, the patent examiners are not required to review the compliance, the validity, the merits of affidavits or declarations. And if they do it wrong or don't do it at all, it's called a non-error-based assessment. They don't get dinged. There's no quality point one way or another if you file these declarations. They're also not required to correctly apply case law. It's very hard to think how do you examine in a situation like that where those key drivers are not even part of what they're working towards.
Okay, thank you. So we're going to move on to our next topic now. And Julie, we're going to go right back to you. Oh. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on inside the office? I mean, there's additional work being imposed on the SPEs. The count system is changing. There's a lot going on. And can you just talk about it and maybe what the morale is like inside the patent office since you're so connected?
Real quickly, I'd like to talk about this patent office. It's unlike any other government agency, and any idea people might have that government employees are kind of got easy, cushy jobs and are lazy. That's never been the situation for our patent examiners. They've been under production and timeliness and quality pressures since the 1836 when we finally got an examination system in place. And they're also unlike other government agencies in that they have or had a union, Patent Office Professional Association, which was unaligned with any other federal union at all. Quite an odd duck there. And from 1965 till last year, that union and management would work together to come up with workarounds to figure out how to squish so much examination through this system. It's like a conveyor belt. They just keep coming on down the pack. And you've got to pick up the next one and do the best you can and move on. It's really quite hard. But for people on the call who might work in law firms, something else I think has been bypassed. And it's the idea, we have that billable hour and you've got the client and you're billing on 6-minute intervals. You pick up your matter, your case, and you work for that one and keep track of that. None of that is kept track of at the patent office. The examiner has to examine so many hours each week, but they don't keep track of, are they examining this case or that case? There's no rubric at all. And it's very easy for the patent examiners to pick up a case and just quickly allow it, and then use that extra time there to try to catch up on the rejections over here. It's applicants are paying basically the same filing fee, and should be getting the same kind of examination. It's this idea that this conveyor belt is issuing patents and they all should be equally valid, but we know they each come in and they're very different. I mean, it's obviously very different. Some do require more work or less work. And it's the examiners every day trying to figure out how to jimmy the system to get the cases through and all. We've had a real cut in training. All these changes the director's rolling out, if there's not training, if there's not a few minutes, if there's no emphasis, there's a reduced quality assurance review. If the quality assurance people aren't reviewing, why should the examiner try to make that change and get on board with that if nobody's going to be there for it? Last year, year before, the patent office was reconfigured as a national security, performing national security work, which then sidelined their union. So the patent corps no longer has this union. And that's a very interesting situation. And the performance plan has been changed again and again, and we don't have copies of it. So we don't know quite what they're working towards right now, but they keep squeezing down on things. And you know that adage, you've got speed, quality, and quantity picked too. And right now, speed seems to be the thing that's real driver, the backlog, and quickly clear the backlog. And you juxtapose that with the patent prosecution highway applications. The majority of those are filed by Chinese entities, watchlisted Chinese entities. They land on the examiner's desk. They're claiming sanctioned subject matter, weaponized drones, you name it. And they get picked up and examined in, what, 100 days, 200 days, start to finish, from filing to being issued as a patent. And meanwhile, the backlog, if you're in Technology Center 1600, where all our chemical, drugs, pharmacy, all our biotech inventions are, all the things in your medicine cabinet are, the backlog for a first office action is 26 months. That's your average backlog. Ouch. Those cases are going to be accumulating PTA, and PTA is going to be pushing out the patent term and delaying generic drug entry.
All right. Thank you. I'd like to open it up to the other three panelists now on this topic, and maybe we'll go back to Noelle. Is there anything that comes up for you when we talk about this topic that you want to share with the audience?
Not really. This isn't my topic, John.
Fair enough. You're going to be big on the next one, I know. What about Clint? Are you seeing gripes from the patent office when you interview cases?
100%. You know, there's in particular one examiner stands out that I speak to frequently. She's a really good examiner. She's been with the office for a while. I know she takes her job seriously and works really hard. I think most examiners do, but I know this one does for sure. And she said, like, her biggest comment was, All examiners are being treated like they're bad examiners, which, you know, I get that would, you know, bust morale. And it's pretty consensus across the board when you talk to examiners that they don't feel like they're being treated particularly fairly. I know that's not the intent. You know, we need to get the backlog down, you know, and so we need to put, you know, ways in place for it. But I think that probably the biggest flaw of getting the backlog down and the complaint of examiners I've talked to is getting rid of what they call other time, non-examination time. And so if you're a new examiner at the patent office, from my understanding of things, you can really only get trained by your SPE, which is, you know, the supervisor. And at this point, SPEs, you know, are examining applications again. And up until recently, we're reviewing every office action that was issued. Director Squire sat down with the SPEs and actually listened to them and scrapped the program, which honestly, that says a lot about him, that he was willing to do that. And I hope he does more of it in the future. But if you have only SPEs and not primary examiners, you know, examiners that are very experienced, often way more experience in the actual art unit than the SPE is. There's SPEs that are, you know, supervisors in an art unit that they did not examine in, and they're not an expert of the technology. So if you are pulling primary examiners out of the process, you're hurting, you know, the junior examiner's ability to examine patent applications in a quality manner, and you're hurting applicants by either unnecessarily rejecting applications, which is more common than unnecessarily allowing them, or, you know, someone that can't really search the art well and allows a patent that should not have been issued. No.
Okay. Thanks. Eli, what about you? Are you having a similar experience?
Yeah, well, I think actually what Julie said about the union is kind of interesting. You know, I'll say that obviously the labor union at the USPTO has been a source of pain for the leadership there over the years in terms of getting things done. But I think they played an important role in that whatever the leadership had in mind, they would scrutinize it, find every angle, do everything possible to delay it and present it. But by the time finally something was, any change was put through for the examiners, you know, it was fairly vetted, and the examiners felt that at least there was some kind of input. And if some examiners weren't happy, their ire was towards the union, not towards the leadership. And I think the leadership actually now probably realizes that. That I actually had on my podcast, I had Jerry Larango, deputy commissioner of the USPTO, and he was talking about all these big changes that they put in place. And I think the political appointees who did have a lot of experience with examination, and usually they don't, they said, we have this backlog, we have these examiners, civilian leadership, how can we solve this problem? And, you know, the easiest thing to do is like, well, let's just make examiners do more work and find a way to do it, you know? And usually, and this is General Wang, he said that usually this would go through a big back and forth process with a labor union where it would get adjusted. And because that wasn't in place, they just put in place like what their initial ideas were, which were in some ways kind of half-baked, like the streamlined review. And that's why, you know, it's been withdrawn. So I think the USPTO leadership kind of realizes it, but I think at the end of the day, the examiners, you're not going to squeeze more out of them. I think that's kind of the thing. The examiner's going to optimize. If I'm unhappy, how am I going to get what I need to do done without getting in trouble? That's what they're going to optimize for. But really what you want them to optimize for is, I'm happy, so I'm just doing my work and not thinking about, not getting in trouble and stuff like that. So that's what you want to optimize for, and that's how you're going to get rid of the backlog. I think it's that. I think if an examiner actually told me this the other day, he goes, the thing is, if I don't allow an application, I won't get an error. But if I allow an application, I might get an error. And if you have examiners, even like 20% of examiners thinking in that way, that's just not good. It's not good for applicants. It's not good for the patent office. So I think that's really the core of the issue. And, you know, the leadership really has to figure out. And I think they're aware of this. They're aware of this sentiment. Director Squires has responded to it. But they want to figure out a way to kind of feel, at least know, let the examiners and the supervisors know that they're being included in whatever the policy, in the process of whatever policy changes are made. And I think that alone, I think is a positive, will be a positive.
All right. Thanks, guys. Go ahead, Clint.
I have a quick comment, and I've mentioned this before. I think I mentioned it on Eli's podcast when Julie and I were on there. But the best way to get the backlog down is to encourage examiners to reach out to like applicants and tell them exactly how they feel about the patent application. If you feel like it's garbage and you don't think anything in there is patentable, they should tell the applicant that. If you think like, hey, these claims are way too broad, I'll allow this, tell the applicant that. That's the easiest way to get the backlog down.
Yeah, and the incentives need to be in place for
that. 100%. Yep. And I actually asked this question to, you know, someone in USPTO leadership, and the response was essentially, well, different examiners like to examine, you know, applications differently. Different applicants like to, you know, prosecute applications differently, which that's fine, but doesn't mean you can't encourage different behavior.
Illustrate that point, examiners actually get credit now for delaying prosecution. If they push to have an RCE, they delay prosecution, they have to be backlogged. But that's how some examiners meet their own production requirements. And it's the examiners who don't do that are probably like working more and putting themselves at a disadvantage. So it's kind of doesn't make sense that you'd want to kind of encourage that kind of behavior.
Yeah. And it puts the applicant in a difficult position too, because you file the RCE when you're close to allowance, you're giving the examiner another chance to reject it. And if the examiner does allow it, you've just rewarded bad behavior in a way, in my view. And, but what can you do? I mean, that's the game at this point.
Yeah. And I had an examiner, actually, I had somebody who works with me. He said, the examiner said 99% chance I'll allow it if you file the RCE. And I'm like, you know, just let's just tell the class the RCE, because, you know, like it's if the examiner is already working with us and being reasonable, so it should be a give and take. But I completely, you know, appreciate the examiner's position. He doesn't want to just allow it without getting the additional credit for doing that that he can. So that's where he is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there should be some type of pilot program where you pay for like an examiner interview before your first office action, or, you know, like you pay additional fees. So you're paying for the examiner to spend a little additional time to think, you know, more thoroughly about what the examiner would allow based on the search. And it would, I think, work in everybody's advantage. It would be money well spent by applicants.
All right. Thanks, guys. We're going to move on to our next topic for the sake of time. And that topic is post-grant proceedings. I don't think it's any secret that Director Squires has been making waves here. He has started using discretionary denials to really drop the institution rate. And as a result, parties are going now for ex parte re-exam to try to knock out patents as part of a broader litigation strategy. And Noel, I want to bring you in because this is really where you have a lot to say. And if you could just give our audience an overview of what you're seeing, what the trends are, what the problems are, I think it would be really useful to everyone to hear that.
I was muted. So just to sort of set the stage, the post-grant proceedings have really evolved quite tremendously over the past year to year and a half. If you were to ask what the normal process was in post-grant procedure for a party that was an unwilling licensee, or maybe they were accused of patent infringement in a lawsuit, the normal best practice would have been to file an IPR, an inter partes review request with PTAB. And in most cases, there's sort of two steps to this. One, they would be instituted or not, potentially. And then you would go through the true exam, and both parties would submit briefing and have experts. And there would be a PTAB judge that would decide this. And while this is still an available mechanism, what we're seeing in the change from prior to the current administration is in the past, almost everything was getting instituted. So if you didn't like a patent for whatever reason, and you didn't have to be accused of infringing, right? You could file an IPR. In fact, you could file multiple IPRs. And in fact, you could hire a mysterious third party to file IPRs essentially on your behalf if you can hide the money well enough. And it would be incredibly hard for a patent owner to challenge that. Even get any kind of discovery in the PTAB process under Vidal was almost verboten. You couldn't do it. So what you're seeing is it was a relatively cheap way for folks to kill large numbers of patents in the American system. And this is what was happening for years and years. Understandably, patent owners expressed a lot of concern about this. They had concern during the Iancu administration, but during the Vidal administration, the number of IPRs filed exploded, and the institution rate was incredibly high, something like 70 to 80%. Once you get through that door, then the question is, how many of these patents are getting killed of that 70 to 80%? Over half, certainly. Oftentimes, depending on the subject matter and the PTAB judge, much, much higher. So I'm sure as someone fighting a patent, that would be a very interesting way to proceed to kill a patent you didn't like or kill multiple patents you didn't like. Under Squires, what has really changed is one of the first things, and I think it was before he actually got appointed, so it was under Coke Morgan Stewart, was for them to say, you know, discretionary denial is something we're going to take seriously. And there are several bases upon which we can say this is not something that we're going to institute. And then later on, they sort of said it's a gating factor of the executive, meaning Director Squires, having the ability to deny institution of the IPRs. Once that process began at PTAB, we saw two things. One, high volumes, and in fact, the overwhelming majority of IPRs filed were not instituted. The director took his discretion to deny them for a variety of reasons, one of them being settled expectations is a concept we've heard several times, which means a patent has existed, it's been issued, it's been granted, it's been cited by other patents, it's been marked on products, all those things for many years. And so the idea that now we're going to file an IPR, it's past that time when it makes sense to do that. The other, which has always been around, but frankly has just not been given enough credit, is pending litigation and the timeline to trial. I can't even speak to how many times I've heard, well, you have a patent case you filed and it's going to go to trial. Well, we know the duration to patent trial is often 5 years in this country, but they would still use that as a basis to proceed with the IPR. In this case, now under Squires, a basis to discretionarily deny and put that with the trial judge and the district court to handle it. That does two things. One, it reduces the case load for PTAB. Number two, it puts a lot of emphasis and pressure on those district court judges. And I will say that's a little bit of a side effect of all of this and this change with PTAB and institutions going down, is that a lot of this is moving to the district court judge. And I would say generally the district court judges are freaking out and maybe not that well trained to deal with these complex patent matters, except for a handful of really sophisticated jurists in this country, many of whom are in Texas. I won't name them. But I will say that there are a lot of wonderful judges who are just not trained on patent matters. And so this has put more of a workload on them. And I think under the Squires administration, it would continue to do so, because I do think something they're focused on is removing a lot of the caseload from PTAB altogether. So now that I've spoken to the change of PTAB, what did that result in? It resulted in a change of tactic by the unwilling licensee, or the petitioner, as we call them in PTAB. They switched very quickly. Maybe there was one lobbyist meeting somewhere at Big Tech, but they all decided, now we're going to file ex parte re-exams. And there's a difference between, and there are a lot of differences between ex parte re-exams and PTAB filings and IPRs. Particularly, the IPR has a one-year timeline from a filed litigation. And that's important, right? Because you don't want to be holding up a trial by waiting until the eve of trial, filing an IPR, and then saying, hey, judge, there's an IPR. And then the judge saying, oh, good, I don't have to try this case. Let's stay it. And it gets stayed for two more years. So that one-year limitation is really important. The ex parte re-exam does not have that. And one might say the flip side to that would be it should not hold up or take precedent over a pending litigation. Currently, there's no rule that says that. But that is one of Director Squires' stated motivations in stopping the institutions of IPRs. So one could surmise, and I do believe that, so there was an April 2026 pre-order procedure that Director Squires put out on this topic. And based upon that and other statements he's made, one would believe that parties should be not using or filing ex parte re-exams to essentially stay trials. And trial is still the preferred mechanism for dealing with those disputes. But other than that, there are a number of other reasons ex parte re-exams are different than IPRs. In particular, what's interesting is you can actually go through the process, and once the filing has been made, the petitioner kind of steps away. At least that's how it always has been. However, what we're seeing now is a new tactic, is that the petitioner, the filer of the ex parte re-exam, is now filing additional filings and extra paperwork to try and keep the conversation going, to put more evidence in, to make it a more complex proceeding, i.e. what an IPR was. They're trying to just import all that behavior into ex parte re-exams. Now, why ex parte re-exams are so different is because if there is a dispute over claim language or an issue with prior art, that the USP, the PTAB thinks is problematic, there's the opportunity to amend the patent, not kill the patent necessarily, and that is a potential outcome, but to amend the patent. That's great for patent owners in some ways, but if you think about it in the context of litigation, it's moving the bar on what the patent is, which then the potential infringer will use as a basis not to proceed at trial because they don't actually have certain patent claims for the trial. So there are all these very interesting nuances to moving to an ex parte re-exam strategy that were not something that came into play with IPRs. So what we're seeing, just very high level, petitioners are filing ex parte re-exams. Director Squires has been flagged on the issue. He's now considering what to do about this. And he's allowing pre-institution briefing by patent owners to try and turn off the tap. How quickly is that going to be successful and change the tide? I'm just not sure. What is going to be the long-term outcome of that? I'm not sure. But if we looked at it as a tactic, and then we looked at the hesitance towards Director Squires, you can look to all the Federal Circuit filings and the Supreme Court certs that have been filed with regard to decisions Director Squires has made, both with IPR, ex parte, and generally for the organization. And I think you can see that it's going to continue to be just a hostile response to the Squires administration for the USPTO.
All right. Thank you very much. That was great. So we've only got a couple of minutes left, but Noel, I want to go back to you for one more thing. Beyond what Director Squires is thinking about doing right now, are there any other things you can think of that he might do to stop, you know, ex parte re-exam just from being the new vehicle of the day for invalidating patents and, you know, basically just the same overall litigation strategy staying the same?
I mean, I think he's just going to, so there's a section 325D discretionary denial, right? That really hasn't been fruitful in the past, and it hasn't been something patent owners have even done. Patent owners are doing that now, and I think that's the perfect opportunity for Director Squires to sort of insert himself again and say, this is not going to be how we do this. We're not going to get what I think is a 630% increase of ex parte re-exams or whatever that percentage is over 1 year period. It's just not sustainable. So I do think that probably the same sort of pre-institution mechanisms are going to come into play for ex parte re-exam.
Okay, great. Thanks. We've only got a couple minutes left. So I think we'll just go around the horn one more time. And for concluding thoughts, if you all don't mind just, you know, casting them in terms of whether the patent office is actually going in the right direction or not overall. Julie, let's start with you.
Yes, I think the patent office is making changes to go in the right direction. And what we have seen Director Squires put in place for the PTAB, I think in the last month, he is turning his attention to the examining core. I understand there's all sorts of stuff coming out really quickly right now. And so what litigators might be wondering about with the PTAB, maybe now folks prosecuting patents in front of the examining core might also be watching the news. Things are happening.
All right. Eli, let's go to you next.
Yeah, I think they inherited a lot of problems and they're definitely doing the right things, putting in the right directions. But although it seems like it's been forever, you know, there's two and a half years left of the Trump administration. The real question is whether any of the things that they are doing now will outlast that. So that's kind of the key.
Okay, thanks. Clint, you're next.
Yeah, I definitely think things are moving in the right direction. I hope Squires continues to honestly listen to people inside the patent office. You know, this is a way to best improve things. And they, you know, they have to hire more patent examiners and train them well. I think that's the ultimate solution to everything. And then, you know, I would say that it's really not good for the patent system for things to change every time a new director is elected, because people aren't voting for a new USPO director. You know, like it's like the politics of patents is not strongly correlated to the politics of Republican Democrat, you know? So if we want to see certainty in the patent system, you know, we got to get some legislation passed at Congress. Otherwise it's just going to ebb and flow and create uncertainty and, you know, Like, you might be happy when you know, the policies that are in the patent office are aligned with yours, but, you know, it's the pendulum's going to swing even more than it has to.
Yep. All right. Thanks, Clint. Noelle, we'll go back to you now.
Sure. So I think patent owners and innovators have been sort of traumatized ever since the eBay decision, utilizing the patent system in this country. And I agree with everything that everyone else has said, that having the director change based on who's elected president is a really strange thing when you consider sort of patent policy is not directly tied to Democrat versus Republican. And in fact, sometimes it's the opposite of being intuitive where that would lie. So we would love to see laws passed that create more certainty and less of differentiation between the different administrations. One interesting development that I think we all should keep our eye on is the Collision Communications versus Samsung decision. Although it did not result in an injunction, it is discussing the matter in a different way than the eBay decision, in a way that creates some hope for patent owners that injunctions may be possible again. That is something that I've heard Squire say he's also supportive of. So I think that combined with legislation could make some meaningful change beyond this administration.
Great. Well, thank you all. That was a really, really excellent panel. I appreciate your time. Thank you for our viewers for joining us. And one last note, if you are interested in learning more about what Director Squires has been doing with IPRs, we did a webinar about that in the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking on Discretionary Denials back in the fall. You can find it on the FedSox YouTube channel, and it's another really interesting discussion. I think that does it for today. So thank you all for joining us.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.